Living Writers on WCBN FM Ann Arbor. I'm T. Hetzel, and today I'm so happy to have Morgan Parker here in the studio sitting across from me on this wintry day. And we've got Jason behind the glass setting up the songs that Morgan has chosen for today's program. And before we talk about the song, which we will get to, folks, how can we not? You get what you pay for. Essays, Morgan Parker's latest book that's out this year, March, it came out, mm-hmm, right? Mm-hmm. And so it's still
making its way.
It's still like roaring across into the world. Mm-hmm. Like and we're going to talk about it and we're going to hear parts of it or part of it from it. Morgan, why Mary Tyler Moore? And she comes in early in the collection of essays. She's part of, I think, the Nick of, at Night essay. But can you, yeah.
Well, and I will read from that one so we can get an idea. But in writing a memoir, I really wanted to go back and think about what have been the influences in my life, you know, what has shaped me, and thinking about staying up late as a childhood insomniac, watching Nick at Night, and basically keeping time based on what show was on. And, you know, at the time, being a young girl going to school with all of these like chipper white girls, you know, even in sleep, I was kind of consuming, you know,
surrounded
white girl joy. Just the way that was like such a part of almost like solidifying what I could sense, you know, in this really kind of external way, understanding the history of women like that tossing their hats in the air, you know, happily.
Yeah, that was such, I thought, like much later than you, I would say I had my Mary Tyler Moore phase, like literally, I think maybe like 40s or whatever, late 30s, somehow where I was like, because I didn't get to watch a lot of TV. Mm-hmm. And so I did, and I watched that, and I thought about what she meant or so in the quote. Mm-hmm. But I loved how you said, how can she be it? Because it's how that it's so ingrained, emblazoned, mm-hmm, that visual of her that you just described.
Yes, exactly.
Because everyone's moving around her, but there's
all these people. How are you taking up so much room?
Yes, and what's going to happen to
you? You know, I mean, it's just like, you're in, and when I watch it now, I'm just like, she's in the way. Yeah. All these people are trying to get to work, you know, like, good for her having this moment,
right,
of freeze frame, but like, the world isn't freeze framed. Like, there's other people in the world.
It's like genuinely a busy city street.
Mm-hmm.
And also, I think, I don't know if you remember this, but I think the hat just goes out of,
yeah,
out of camera.
Yep.
So it's not
even
like...
She just tosses
like,
it up. It probably lands on someone.
It's yeah, like, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, it's really... it's funny, but it's funny the way that we think of... Obviously, she's the symbol of, like, girl power and independent woman. And that, you know, has been her legacy and the legacy of the show. And I think part of the book was unpacking these things. Like, we have cultural legacies, but then, you know, our personal histories... The things in the world that we're consuming are hitting all of us in different ways. So just because there's a kind of like larger agreed upon cultural legacy of Mary Tyler Moore as representing this moment of like an independent woman working a job and living alone and making it on her own, you know, to me, it was like kind of a constant reminder of who makes it, you know, and what they look like. And it's not me, you know.
And, that this character could think that they could stand there, like you were describing, mm-hmm. to have
right,
that
like
moment.
Who feels allowed? And you know, in thinking about, you know, a lot of this book is kind of tracking my own mental health, and so a lot of it is, why do I feel this way? And why have I felt this way? And what made me first feel this way? So really thinking about what are the messages I was receiving, you know, and understanding.
When we're absorbing so
exactly.
Much.
And especially, you know, as a young child, I mean, I'm talking about 8, 9, you know, what you're consuming at that point is really telling you what the world is like, what to expect in the future, you know? So knowing that these are the things I'm watching, I'm nowhere to be found, you know, but I'm seeing my friends at school. I'm like, that seems like that could be them. Mm-hmm. But what's there for me? I'm the person in the background who like gets someone's hat landed on them, you know? So really thinking about exclusion and like ways that I felt excluded and ways that I have felt, you know, predestined toward struggle. Yeah. And just like a lot of feelings of insufficiency, like really tracking all these things. And obviously there are huge, you know, systems at work to make me feel this way. So, but for me in this book, I really wanted to place those things, you know, like systemic racism, but also the Mary Tyler Moore Show, because they're all equally impactful. Yes. To a young brain, you know, and how a person moves through the world and what they are allowed to expect of the world.
How long was this book in the writing? Because when, by the time we're getting to the end, there's a beautiful untitled essay, untitled because who cares?
Mm-hmm.
And then we have the final chapter. But how long was it in the writing?
6 years, almost. Yeah, 6 years, almost 7. When it came out, my editor texted me and was like, we had a conversation about this book for the first time 7 years ago. And I, you know, it was just the idea of the book. I hadn't written it. So, yeah, I mean, the actual writing was 6 years, but I was living with the ideas and a lot of the themes for a lot longer. A lot of it lived in my head before it kind of found its words.
Is that why the idea of the book came to be? Like, because you felt like these things are finding the word or need to find the words.
Exactly. Yeah. Like, I'm obsessed with these same ideas. You know what I mean? So I have to use the writing process to work it out, you know? And a lot of it was themes that I have explored in my poetry before. And things where I tried it as a poem and the poem wasn't enough of a container for it. Mm-hmm. So some ideas that just needed more room, that needed sentences, that needed quotations from other authors and you know, describing other texts and history. So it was just a matter of, you know, what has been unsaid in the poems, I guess, or what can be re-said, you know, so it wasn't necessarily... I mean, some was coming up with newer ideas or different lenses around the same ideas, but a lot of it was going back into themes that I've already investigated and just doing it in a different container and through a slightly different lens and with a different kind of arc in mind.
Would you mind reading a couple of the titles that just to sort of that connect to that?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so I have a couple of kind of like repetitions that are happening in the titles. One chapter, an early chapter called Everything is a Slave Ship, and another later in the book called Everything is Still a Slave Ship. A lot of the titles are actually, you know, for me, I love like a very, very long you know, personable title, and a lot of these are not that. You know, it's a little bit slightly different.
Well, you get what you pay for. Your titles of your other poems, your young adult novel. Yes.
Yeah, I do love a title. And these were different because there was a lot of play and, like, yeah, language play happening within the essays, so that in a lot of these, the titles are just very simple and stark.
But they're wonderful. We got jokes.
We got jokes. Are we not entertainers? Black people don't go to therapy. George Bush doesn't care about black people. Upended. Plantations. That's. I think I'll be reading that piece tomorrow night at my event.
Thank you for mentioning that, because you're in town for the week, meeting with students in the MFA program and talking with folks. But you're also going to be having two public events. Mm-hmm. One that's at UMA tomorrow. That's Thursday at 5:30 p.m. in the Helmut Stern Auditorium, in person and via Zoom. Mm-hmm. Folks can see you. And then also on Friday, the craft lecture, which we'll talk about later in Angel Hall.
But yeah, it's been fun to read from this book and you know, the essays.
Because it's hard to write, like being with those, like that's what, when we were, before we came on air, you said it's a difficult book.
It is. And it's a lonely one also, you know, so talking about it with people is just a totally different experience. That's, you know, a relief. And, you know, sharing it with other people and reading it out loud into a space instead of just sitting with it, you know, I think is it's important, not just for the writer, but for the reader as well, you know. Yeah.
And you're so, it's so striking to me that you're so conscious of your readers, because that's your last line in your acknowledgments, is to the readers. It's not to, I don't, you know, it's.
Yeah, that's, I mean, at the end of the day, you know, my first book, you know, you don't know if there's readers. You don't know. Second book, you're kind of like, are the readers still going to be there? But by now, I'm like, there's some people that are going to read this. I know that for sure. And, you know, there were times I wanted to stop writing this, as you alluded to. You know, it took a really long time. That untitled essay, you know, says, like, I think I'll just stop. Like, this is taking too long. This is hard. Does it even matter? And when I have those feelings, I just, you know, think of the reader. Like, there's someone receiving this on the other end. And that's just, like, a really good reassurance that writers too rarely get. You know, we spend a lot of time. It's a really kind of a solo act. So being able to get to that other side of now we're in communion, you know, is really important. And it's part of the writing process, you know? I mean, the book is only a book because someone else is reading it, you know? So, yeah, I think it was a relief to get to that part of the writing process instead of just, like, sitting with the stuff on my own.
Yes. I feel like I took us in another direction. Where were you going there?
No, I don't
know.
Remember.
Okay.
We were talking about titles. I don't know.
Oh, wait. Yeah, exactly.
Oh, am I going to read something? Oh, no.
Not yet. Don't worry. Okay, okay. Don't worry. We're back on track. If there ever is a track, then we're back on it, folks. But I thank you for taking the time to say that, because there are these moments where you, no matter who you are as a writer, like, I feel like in this situation, you had also, like, at this point, like you said, there'd been other books before. You had this idea of an audience, and you had an editor who you had talked, pitched an idea to.
Exactly.
And so you knew you had, I mean, that might be a different kind of pressure, too, to have someone waiting.
Oh, definitely. Definitely. Like, this, I mean, if you want it to be good, you gotta wait, you know? Especially when it's, you know, if I wanted to do it fast, I would have written a different book. You know, that's really what it is. It's, I knew that this book, because of the material and how I wanted to approach the material, that it would take some time because, you know, I'm a human. And sometimes in order to write this stuff, you got to have extra therapy appointments. And, you know, it's painstaking. There's a lot more kind of relief and recharging that you need to build into. You can't just, like, you know, it's not a book I could work on every day. It just isn't. If I were writing, you know, a nice little family drama novel, you know, maybe. But with something like this, you know, wanting to be as honest as possible and as naked really as possible, you just can't, you don't have it in you to do every day. Not as a depressed person as I am, not during a global pandemic, you know. There's just a lot of things that get in the way of doing it as a pure act, you know. So there was a lot of kind of like self-protection that was happening because, you know, I could tell when it's like, I just don't have it in me. And I can tell that the line I'm going to write is just kind of, it's not as good as it would be if I were, you know, up to the challenge.
Yes.
If that makes sense. Yeah.
It completely does. I even feel like on such a different scale, mind you, but even as a reader, mm-hmm. there was a moment in one of the early essays where I couldn't go further because I was having to read you at night, and I needed to go to sleep to come to work super early. Anyway, get out the tiny violins, everyone. But there was like, it happened really early on. So there was a moment where by day, white teachers molded my conscience. And because of the intensity of class, it was like school right now, I got stuck on that for like at least a night, and where I was like, I'll have to come back to this tomorrow
totally.
In the day.
Totally.
Know? And it was, and it's just like, it's so I know that the scale of it is so different from like the actual, like the creating part of it and you being the one in driving mm-hmm, this. Mm-hmm. But it's just strange to even think, like you said, it's a book is about finding readers.
Totally.
And
you know, I was aware that this would be a hard one for readers, you know, and
yeah.
I, even on tour.
I should say I'm a white instructor.
Yeah, yeah.
Because this is radio. Like, the power of the airwaves. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
I mean, I even told folks, I mean, one thing was like, you know, I've said to white people, like, it's going to be hard, but you have to read it.
Yes.
You must, you know, and if you feel bad, imagine how I have felt for 36 years of my life.
Completely.
You know?
Exactly.
You know?
Yeah.
So it's like,
it's not about people. I don't know. It's not about feeling. Well, okay. Well, if you say it's about feeling bad, say it. Like, whatever. Like, I think we have to say, but it's also like, you've got to be in the, like, these are the real truths. Like, this
I'm
is like
bearing witness, yes. And it's your responsibility
as a human being,
yeah,
to
receive. You know, I mean, if other people are willing to bear witness to their lives,
yes,
we have to, you know, as fellow citizens, listen.
Yes,
you know that
yes.
That's really all it is.
It doesn't preclude someone else from bearing their witness.
Absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely. Yeah. And the more of us that do, the better.
Oh, yeah.
But for that reason, you know, knowing that I did want to bear honest witness to my life, that's not so easy. You know, it's way easier to sugarcoat certain things and leave certain things out. So it was really a challenge I placed on myself to, like, you know, really show up and do what was hard, you know?
Yeah. You can feel that.
Yeah.
In
yeah.
the book.
There's tension even in it. And That untitled chapter, I originally was not going to include it. It's italicized in the book and untitled, obviously. I wasn't going to include it. And then at the end, I was like, you know what? This is all, it's all part of it, you know? Readers should see that I struggled to write this. You know, I think there's a way that we want the finished product to be devoid of the process. You know, there's a body on the other end. And I think, obviously, this is a world where we forget each other's humanity all the time. And even on authors, which, you know, and you're reading it and you know it's emotional. You know I'm talking about myself and my own struggles. And yet there's a way that we're still able to be like, this is a product. And so you're over it, right? Like, you're now...
There's art.
Mm-hmm.
Like the art like is supposed to distance it. In
yes,
some...
exactly. And people want to receive it in that way, or, you know, they want to ask whatever questions, or, you know, like, just like kind of as if it's a book about a hockey game, you know what I mean, or whatever. But
that's
you know,
at six. Or no.
Yeah, exactly. That's the next show. Yeah, but I do think it's like, you know, you have to remember that, yeah, someone had to write this, you know, and that was hard, you know. Just because we make it look easy doesn't mean, you know, that it's not. And just because I can do it doesn't mean that it's easy for me to do it. So I do think it's an important just to even pause and remind the reader that I'm a person on the other side. And it is, you know, it's a little bit of just like a confession. And, you know, I hope other writers, you know, get something out of that. Like, yeah, man, that's not, because that's the other thing. We all look at each other like, wow, that person wrote that book really fast. Like, what am I doing wrong? Right. You know? So I think it's important to like demystify all parts of ourselves, you know, including that writing process. And for me, it was also an opportunity to point out what was difficult about it. And I think it was not always the things that people would expect. Like it was, yeah, I don't know. The barriers were not just dealing with politics or, you know, it was a lot of, it was that, but it also was interpersonal. And there's just a lot that goes into really honestly looking back at one's life and really honestly looking at one's mental health journey. You know, there's a lot that goes into that. And then there's a lot that goes into just like being a Black American woman since 2017, which is, you know, so balancing all of those things, but also having given myself the challenge to be honest, it really meant that, yeah, it was a challenge. So I was glad to finish it. I was glad to finish it. And of course, my agent was like, how about something a little lighter next time? I'm like, yeah, we'll try. We'll try. Really? Like, this wasn't funny to you? I thought this was LOL.
All caps.
Yeah.
Was there, Morgan, was there a like, well, okay, I think there is a reason that it was placed just before we move away from this one essay, right where it was in the book.
Mm-hmm, right before the final essay.
Yeah. Could you talk about that a little?
Yeah. I guess, yeah, I almost wanted to end the book with that, you know, though the last line of that is like, I don't even want to do this anymore, or like, I don't even want to talk about this.
Yes.
And so I think I wanted to show that, like, I'm still going to, even if I don't want to. Like, there's something in that of, like, wanting to quit but not. And, like, here's just the last thing I'm going to say. Reparations. You know what I mean? Like, that's kind of how it is. Where it's like, oh, with my last breath, please give us reparations. You know?
Yes.
So not wanting to exclude... Sorry. Not wanting to exclude it. But using it almost as an entry or as part of the final essay, you know, as part of this kind of evidence of exhaustion, I guess, you know.
Because it seems to me also that it could have been, because it's the weight that it has, mm-hmm. there and the work that it's doing would be different if it was placed in different parts.
Absolutely. Yes, absolutely. And that's one of the reasons I originally was kind of like, I don't think I'm going to put this anywhere. It's just something that I had to get off my chest. But yeah, then thinking about it as, no, this is part of the process and this is part of the argument that I'm building.
Yes.
You know, if I am building an argument, then this is a hinge, you know, and
yes,
this is a context for the final essay.
You mentioned, like, it's interesting, you said when we first started talking, you said my memoir, and why do you think it was important to use essays as the way to build the memoir?
Yeah, I never wanted to write like a straight narrative memoir. And I mean, the way that we think about the genre also is interesting. I mean, I told I think it was like an Uber driver on my tour, I said I had a nonfiction book, and he said, what happened to you? And I think we think of like a memoir as like, oh, you must have been kidnapped. Like,
yeah, yeah. Like, it's going to be, you know, let's get this tragedy out.
Exactly.
Right? And, yeah. But a singular.
Right. Yeah.
You're like, well, this is many things
moment.
Unfolding.
Yeah. I was like, yeah. I was just here, just being a Black American. That's what happened to me. You know?
Yeah.
I lived. So I never really approached, I wanted it to be, you know, a story of my life. And as a first book of essays, it does kind of, there is memoir in it, but it's not necessarily like, you know, as my child. But the well, I keep saying that the most memoir-y parts are me in the therapist's office. So you kind of keep returning. That's when you're kind of like with me in a different period of my life. So in thinking about, you know, ordering the book, that's generally kind of the order of therapists that I've had, you know, from my first therapist to my last white therapist to, you know, my current therapist didn't make it. And I had to apologize to her for that. But I was like, I think our work is not done. So. But
it's funny, the considerations.
Exactly.
You're like, you feel like you have to, because they'll eventually see the book.
Oh, yeah.
Actually, you probably talked a lot about the book. Yeah. I'm like, who am I kidding?
That's definitely necessary. It was the book I most talked about in therapy, for sure. And, you know, a lot of the themes. It was funny. I did send the galley to my therapist, and she was like, I mean, obviously, she's like, we've talked about all this stuff. So she was like, it was amazing, but it also wasn't unfamiliar. You know, I wasn't surprised about anything. Because, yeah, I had to, like, really kind of obsess and spiral over these same themes. And a lot of it is what affects my mental health. And so a lot of it we were talking about in the, you know, in the present tense, you know, even as I'm talking about history. And I mean, she's a Black woman also. So it's a different type of therapy than I had in the book, where I'm able to like talk about these things and have more of like a shorthand about it. And I don't have to explain to her, you know, how I feel about, you know, racism. she knows.
Do you feel like I wish it didn't, like, how could come I couldn't find you sooner sort of feeling? You know how you have that with different mm-hmm. people who you meet, and mm-hmm. then I'm wondering if with this particular therapist, if it was like that too.
I mean, definitely in terms of like, I had looked for a Black woman therapist for a really long time, and it's hard. It's really hard. Even in New York and LA, it's hard. And especially, you know, I was looking for someone who could prescribe, and I was, you know, I don't know. It's hard. And then there's insurance and all that crap. So yeah, it definitely was like, wow, this really would have saved me. But I knew that already, you know, like I knew that when there's a chapter where I break up with my white therapist, and at that time, it's like, I knew that I had to find someone else. I knew that there's time being wasted in here in this office where I'm having to, like, explain things to her. So it was such a relief to, you know, have this relationship with my new therapist and, you know, be able to bring those things in, but not have to harp on, you know what I mean? Harp on them or do any kind of like performative discussion of the latest Black person to die, you know?
The shorthand, what you said mm-hmm. makes so much sense.
Absolutely. Yeah.
And with the, I'm trying to also imagine with the, because you mentioned, oh, it's not unfamiliar when the therapist was reading the galley or so. Were you drafting? Like, how did that intersect with the writing of it? Like, would you be writing it and then talk about it? Or just to take it to process for a moment for you, how do you use that?
I go back and forth. And okay. I started doing this, you know, even with my poems. And it's funny, I was telling some students, and I always bring this up because, I mean, I always say time is the best editor. And it's true. And when I was writing Magical Negro, there were multiple times where I started writing a poem, you know, and then suddenly the poem kind of goes somewhere different and I see where it's going and I'm like, okay, I can't do that yet. I need like two more therapy sessions before I can actually write where this poem wants to go. So learning that about myself, like learning where I needed to become another person or like another version of myself in order to edit it was like a really important lesson for my process in terms of use both of these things. Like, and I kind of like things will come up in therapy that I'm like, oh, that's something I want to write into, you know, or I'm stuck somewhere in a poem and I realize, oh, wow, this is bringing up something that I'm going to need to discuss, you know, and then, yeah, so just knowing, like, I can be the person that's going to edit this poem, but I'm not yet. And I got to go become that person first, and then I can return to it. I think I went into this, the writing of this book, knowing that. And so being aware and being looking for those moments, you know, instead of just like confronting them when they arrived, but like looking for, oh, here's something that I like, I would like to write about, but I'm not ready. And I like, I can't really formulate it. That kind of shaped, you know, where my therapy sessions would go, or, you know, things would come up in a poem and I'd be curious about it. And I'd take that to my doctor, you know, so utilizing both of them and kind of having those two practices be in conversation. Yeah. And just utilizing, like, I guess, what comes up, no matter what it is.
It, yeah. And it's so interesting that you're saying you're going, you had to be a different kind of person, like that too, in the future person. And you had a sense of it. And then it strikes me, then it makes me, well, it makes me think of that. That's also you, or any of us, if you keep writing your whole life, you're a different kind of, I mean,
totally.
I guess it's self-evident, but in a way to actually confront that, like you are a different person.
Exactly.
You wouldn't have written the same thing.
Exactly. And that's not something, and that's something I like to remind students, because it's not something you're thinking about when you're a student. You're like, I got my voice and now I shall, you know, there's a way that they're like, but I figured it out and now I just write this forever.
Dialed in.
Yeah. But it's like, no, you have to re-find your voice like all the time. And for me, it's like finding it in a different genre or whatever, you know, but it's also the voice grows with you. You grow out of it. You know, you develop and the world changes and language changes, you know. So it is important to know that like sometimes the work is ahead of you, you know, like sometimes there's, I think the poem is like way ahead of my own thought process, you know, and it's like I have to catch up to it. I have to do a little work on myself to meet the poem where the poem wants to be. But the opposite would be, okay, this poem is going somewhere different than where what I wanted, so I'm just going to like muscle it back into what I wanted it to be. You know what I mean? Because that's what I can handle. So just learning not to do that, or not to be like, oh, that seems too hard, so I'm just gonna quit. You know what I mean? Like learning when it's like to follow it, but also, you know, in order, what do you need to do in order to follow it? You know, how do you need to take a break or take care of yourself or become a different person in order to write really what the work wants to be, instead of like, you know, just kind of imposing your own will onto it. That never, the work always suffers for that. You know, you can tell when it's half-assed. And that's why, sorry.
That,
oops. But hey, that's a donkey. That's what I meant.
That's right.
It was half a donkey.
I love donkeys. We're going to take a short break today on Living Writers. It's so good to have Morgan Parker here in the studio. The book on the table with us, You Get What You Pay For. Essays. A quick word before we take the break. Morgan Parker will be at UMA tomorrow reading in Helmut Stern Auditorium at 5:30 to 6:30 in person. You can go also via Zoom. And then again on Friday, December 6th in the Robert Hayden Room in Angel Hall on the third floor there at 10 a.m. I'm T. Hetzel. You've got Living Writers. We have Jason behind the glass. We'll be back.
Thug 'em, some love 'em, leave 'em, cause I don't need 'em. Take 'em out the hood, keep 'em looking good, but I don't beat 'em. First time they fuss, I'm breezing. Talking about what's the reasons. I'm a pimpin' every sense of the word. Better trust and believe 'em. In the cut where I keep 'em, till I need it, till I need to be the gust in it. Beep beep, then I'm picking 'em up, let 'em play with the truck. Mini chicks wanna put chicken fists in cup. Divorce him and split his bucks. Just because you got good, I'ma break bread so you can be living it up. Did I pass with nothing? Y'all be frontin'. Me give my heart to a woman? Not for nothing. Never happen. I'll be forever mackin'. Hard cold as assassins. I got no passion. I got no patience. And I hate waiting. Choke. And let's ride.
Welcome back. If you're just tuning in, you're just in time. Morgan Parker is here on Living Writers. You Get What You Pay For, the book on the table with us out with One World this year. Morgan, so that song, it was hard to fade out to come back on. But yeah, we only have this hour together, so we're back.
Yeah, that song, well, I listened to it so many times in writing.
How many times?
I know, right? Well, I watched the video a lot also. And I remember I was at a residency and I felt really bad because I was in kind of a common room. And I know someone was like in another room where they probably just heard that hook over and over and over.
Gonna go.
Me just like pressing.
Check on Morgan.
Rewind. Yeah. yeah, so fun. I knew I wanted to write an essay about that song. I did not expect it to be like 20 pages. I'm like, what is wrong with me? Of course, you know, I just really had to go deep in it. But interesting history behind not just the song, but the making of the video. And yeah, there was like a whole lawsuit attached to the song. Yeah, so it's there was like so much to uncover. And then I spent some time talking about the spoof that Lonely Island did of, it was like called I'm on a Boat or something like that. So the idea of these rappers on boats.
On SNL then.
Yes, exactly. And that's kind of like, it's all a play on the kind of, the Big Pimpin' video was the original like rappers on boats with girls dancing. And yeah,
oh,
that was
right. Okay.
The year 2000.
Oh, the year.
Yeah, it was.
Back in the time machine.
Yeah, it was like heralding people on boats, like that was it. It was a whole new era of rap. So I spent a lot of time kind of digging into that, and it seems silly, but I'm like, no, deep dive, dive on that.
Trust your instincts, right?
Right.
Like the things that are rewind. Okay, again,
Because you know there are things that stick out in culture, and it's like, for me as a writer, I'm just like, but why? You know, like, what are all the circumstances surrounding this? And why do we keep coming back to certain things? And yeah, I mean, even thinking about that song as capturing a particular era, you know, and I think I was like 12. So, you know, really like influential time. and, you know, yeah, even like Jay-Z's story, such an interesting time in his career.
Because when you're 12, it's everything is sponge.
Mm-hmm. Exactly, right? Exactly.
And the people are, you look up to them in a way without filters or so.
Mm-hmm.
Or, not that people aren't doing that sometimes with celebrity
right.
culture.
Right.
Anyway, but.
But yeah, as a kid, you don't know to have. You don't know how to have discernment. You know what I mean? Like,
right.
you have to, you kind of have to develop discernment.
Yes.
So, yeah, you're like receiving everything on the same plane, you know? Yeah.
Okay, before we get talking.
Yes.
This is the time-honored tradition of the bio and the dust jacket. And then we get to hear, which one are you going to read? Which part?
I think Nick at Night.
Perfect. Okay. Here's the bio, folks. Morgan Parker is a poet, essayist, and novelist. She is the author of the young adult novel, Who Put This Song On?, and the poetry collection, Other People's Comfort Keeps Me Up at Night. There Are More Beautiful Things Than Beyoncé and Magical Negro, which won the National Book Critics Circle Award. The recipient of an NEA fellowship and winner of a Pushcart Prize, Parker has been hailed by the New York Times as a dynamic craft person of considerable consequence to American poetry. She received her bachelor's in anthropology and creative writing from Columbia University and an MFA in poetry from NYU. Parker is a Cave Canem graduate fellow and creator co-curator of the Poets with Attitude reading series with Tommy Pico. With Angel...
Nafis.
Is it Angel or...
Angel.
I should have asked you before. Angel Nafis. She is the other Black Girl Collective. Morgan Parker lives in Los Angeles with her dog, Shirley.
Shirley.
Shout out to Shirley. What's Shirley doing right now?
She's with my parents. I just got the update. She's in the suburbs, roving around the backyard, living her best life. Oh.
Is she also in L.A.?
Yeah.
Okay. All right. So under a sunny sky at the moment. In a dog coat here.
No.
Yeah.
No coats. No. She likes a hoodie, you know, so it's like fuzzy inside. But that's all.
Well, Shirley might be back. Who knows? I mean, and in our conversation, folks, not like, and shout out to Shirley and your folks since, And while we're at it, hi, Mom.
Right.
I know Mom said she's going to listen. So hi, Mom. But okay, Morgan, let's get to your words. Do you mind reading some for us? Just so we get a sense of what we've been talking about.
Awesome. Okay. Yes, this is a pretty short one. At night. It's probably worth noting that I was an adolescent insomniac, if for no other reason than why and what I did instead. I worried. Worry was both reason and recourse. That it was sinful to feel, wonder, and want what I did. That the rapture would come. That angels were watching me. That God could see me digging for gold up my nose. That God could hear me wish my bullies emotional pain, that God knew I was dreading the rapture, that I was not saved, that I wasn't ready to be judged, that I wouldn't wake up, that I'd wake up to an empty, ruined world, that I was somehow evil or perverted or defective, destined for banishment, and it was only a matter of time before everyone found out. Either when I stayed gravitational as they flew into the sky on Jesus's cue, or in some other sinister way, tomorrow at recess. I worried I was already unforgivable. As I got older, of course, my worries turned to boys and stuff. Grades, what impressions I was making with teachers or friends, if I shouldn't have said that, why I said that, all the ways I can and must be better tomorrow. Y2K, and then anthrax and bin Laden and the general air of terror I was beginning to perceive in every news story, TV show, school code, sermon, and playground rumor. But there's no way any of those things is extricable from the rest. By the time the darkest of such social worries had joined my spiritual night terrors, I had a TV in my room. Nick at Night played until 6 in the morning, no infomercials. By day, white teachers molded my conscience and behavior, how to walk with a smile and a pep, who to pray to and whose souls to pray for. By day, I was learning to be vigilant. I was learning what earned adoration and affection, what might earn me grace. By sleepless, vigilant night, when I wasn't worrying about my soul, I was absorbing the nostalgia and influences of a baby boomer. By day, traditional morals and impossible standards. By night, traditional morals, impossible standards. The development of a Negro child will vary depending on behaviors modeled, media consumed, lessons absorbed, and the belief systems to which they are exposed and by which they are evaluated, such that those beliefs become the standards by which the child might evaluate themselves, perhaps their very worth. In terms of television, I was raised in two timelines. At the turn of the millennium, I was consuming mid-century media. Benny Goodman, Louis Armstrong, I Love Lucy, Bewitched, alongside TRL, Sugar Ray, and Christina Aguilera's Genie in a Bottle video. By day, it was the 1950s in class and the 90s at lunchtime, and by night, on the cusp of sleep, it was the interiors of 1960s family homes and 1970s offices. A desert island with a white Urkel and a big-titted blonde, a flirty blonde genie whose very wink was a spell. I remain one of the only millennials familiar with Rhoda. All of it twirled and twisted in my young head. By night, even in drowsy anguish, I soaked in Brady family ideals and Mary Tyler Moore idolatry, the values that reared my teachers, and I absorbed it with the knowledge that their vision and version of the truth was the one that mattered most in terms of my salvation, in terms of what was the right way to be. This is all to say maybe that I'm used to sorting and sifting through information and making my own sense of it, and that I have an unusually long historical view of the politics of desirability, entertainment, and aspiration. Over the late 90s and early 2000s, I began to use Nick at Night programming as a measure of time and anxiety. If Happy Days was on, I wasn't too worried. There was still time for a solid night's sleep. Taxi was cause for mild panic. A good night's sleep no longer possible. Newhart, followed by the Bob Newhart Show, meant time for reckoning. It was creeping up on 5:30, and my only hope was to power nap through the sales pitches for frying pans and Medicaid. Certain shows I skipped and either fell asleep or buzzed the TV back on when they were over. Andy Griffith Whistle, instant mute and rollover. It's still early, not even midnight. All in the Family or Sanford and Son, too brash. Happy Days, often just way too happy from the second the coin hits the jukebox. I usually turned off the Beverly Hillbillies after mouthing along to the theme song. Sometimes I turned off the TV after Mary Tyler Moore tossed her hat with a little spin. Not sure why. She was clever, sharp, not a kitchen-bound housewife or a sex genie, not swooning over swimming pools, movie stars. She was good at her job. Rhoda was awesome, and I'd still wear every single one of their outfits. I was familiar with Mary from the Dick Van Dyke Show, which Nick at Night had been running for a while before airing the Mary Tyler Moore Show, which I gleaned after one or two viewings was not related. While I missed the L-shaped couch and mid-century tables of the Van Dyke household that would no doubt inform my future design tastes, independent Mary was an upgrade. She was girl power. Everybody wanted to root for her. The show was about rooting for her. And subconsciously, her exhilarated grin picked at my self-esteem. As a young girl with big city ambitions and my own spunk, I understood that Mary was meant to reassure and inspire us. But something about the easy way she flings her hat into the air, how just by arriving, she's already made it, told me my success was not as certain. Nice to know it was possible for someone, I guess. My best friend at the time, smiley and theatrical, bore some resemblance. How can Mary just do that? I remember thinking in the dark. All those people rushing in the busy square, and her arms stretched wide as she twirls, oblivious, without consequences. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you, Morgan.
Appreciate it.
I'm glad you chose that one to read. It was and then Jason playing the song.
Yes.
It just feels like this we got a chance to get close to it with you, because you hearing you talk about it beforehand,
mm-hmm.
and then having the time. What was it like to read that one today? Or is that, yeah.
It's, you know, that's an essay that I started. I did not know where it was going to end. It used to have a different ending. I think it was something about Taxi, and I went off. I like kind of went on a tangent about how it's like that Bob James song. And I'm like, now I know that it's this song by Bob James. I'm like, just talking about Taxi, you know, waxing poetic about Bob James. But I'm like,
as one does.
This is actually not just because I'm interested in like the history of jazz doesn't mean that it's part of this book. But
well, actually, it could be if it's in your,
you know what I mean? I know.
Decide.
Yeah.
It's
like,
but
maybe this isn't this
maybe.
One, you know.
But then you decided it wasn't.
Exactly. Yeah. And it was like a moment of like, this is what I, you know, this would be a fun thing to talk about. But like, what is this essay about? And it's not about that, you know. But it was an essay where I didn't know exactly what it was about. I did know I wanted to talk about, you know, being watching Nick at Night all night when I'm supposed to be sleeping as like a teen, but like really watching Nick at Night because I was worried about the rapture and like having like all of this anxiety over insomnia and like trying to drown that out with consuming all of this like old media that like further like solidified these weird morals that I was already being, you know, fed that was that were already making me uncomfortable, you know. So I knew there was something to that, but I wasn't. Yeah, I didn't know what the tone to end on. And I think it's because I didn't exactly know which of all the potential points I wanted to like end on and leave the reader thinking about. And I think I didn't even really. I had to just like follow the hat. You know what I mean? Like I was like, what? And I had to take a minute to be like, what is annoying about it? You know? And I think it just took me a while to, and maybe I had to think about it in the context of this book as well. You know, how is this moment in time going to enhance all the other essays? You know what I mean? Like, how can it, you know, provide a little bit of backstory or evidence for something else? So which parts of that experience are useful to the rest of this book? Writers are always making choices. That's one thing I was harping on the students about today. It's all choice. You know, it's like, yes, I could throw out every idea I have about all the Nick and Knight songs and Bob James and Mary Tyler Moore and whatever, but you know, what is this actual essay trying to say in the context of this book? You know, so I really did have to think about what, first of all, like, what's the ending image? You know, what's the image I want to leave in the reader's head as they continue on to the next chapter? But really, like, what is the kind of takeaway emotion that I got from this time of my life? And what is it that I couldn't say then, you know, that I can look back and reflect and say, yes, that's what's annoying. She's taking up so much space, you know, and even knowing, yeah, like really kind of walking myself through that process of like, why am I annoyed by her? I like Rhoda, you know, mm-hmm. I like her outfit. She's an independent lady. But like, why is it, you know, it's something that I know after a, you know, 30 more years of being around white women, I understand what is annoying, but I didn't then. So it was a little bit of like unpacking what I couldn't put my finger on back then, but which I now, what I now know has affected me the most. You know what I mean?
Yes. And when you say there's so many things to talk about, but I'll pick this one. Do you have like multiple drafts? Because you talk about like the work that might be, mm-hmm. It might be doing. So when you were building this book, You Get What You Pay For, did you have multiple starts across multiple time periods or ideas or the things that you were thinking about? Because you would almost have to have, or was this much further along in the editing process? Because to me, it feels like you were building this essay, but it could have been much further along in the editing process. What happened? How did you work with us?
Yeah, I wasn't writing them in order. And a lot of them were
with an order that it appears.
That they appeared, yes. I ordered it last. And I was switching around the order at, you know, literally texting my, you know, editor, like, I know I just sent you, but here's one more. Like, I hope there's still time. You know, like, this is actually it.
This is the lineup.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
So it was hard to finish essays not knowing what order they would appear in. So a lot of the essays were unfinished for a while because they're all, like, dependent on each other. You know, after I knew that I was writing a collection, then I started thinking, okay, these all have to interact. I knew it wouldn't be, you know, a narrative arc or like a temporal, you know, line through, but arcs are involved. You know, I spend a lot of time ordering even my poetry books, so I knew that that would be a big part of the process in terms of, you know, clarifying for the reader what the journey of the book is, even if there's not like a beginning end, you know, in the traditional sense. So yeah, I mean, it was a lot of like write as much as I can to a point and then go to another one and write as much as I can to a point. And then, you know, there were some paragraphs that moved from one essay to another essay to another essay. There were some like floating paragraphs where I was like, I'm not actually sure until the end, like where this will fit. Should it come here or here.
That's exciting, though. That is dynamic.
It is really dynamic. But it was harder to edit than most books for that reason. And I felt kind of bad because my editor kept asking for pages. And I was like, I mean, I have them, but they're not really ready. You know, it's not the same as like, okay, that poem's done, cross it off. There were a few essays, you know, that were kind of like, all right, these are set. But it's still a lot of it. Yeah, there's a lot of thematic repetition. So it had to come down to, well, where's the first time I'm going to say this? Like, when am I going to introduce this idea? And will it make sense if I, you know, mention this here without introducing it there? And, you know, so there was a lot that I had to juggle all at the same time. And it meant that the process, it felt like I wasn't making progress. You know what I mean? Because it was never like, okay, I can cross that off. It's done.
Right.
Everything was
contingent, mm-hmm, and relying upon.
Exactly. Yeah. So, yeah, that part of the... But it was fun to do. That was like a big puzzle. You know, it was like my brain... Someone posted like a meme. Someone that was doing an event with me posted a meme. It's like a meme of some guy with like a tie and like... I think it's from like, I don't know, It's Always Sunny or something, and he's like got this board of all these like threads connecting and looks like a crazy person, and they like impose like my head on it. It's like what I imagined Morgan's mind was like when she was writing this book, and I was like,
or
accurate,
your,
accurate,
your walls even,
yes,
right,
yeah, lots of, I mean, also just, oh, we're done.
Oh my goodness. Okay.
It's my fault.
No, it's not. You're wonderful. What, we finish your sentence though, Morgan, please. And also lots of, because of like the,
oh my gosh,
walls.
Oh yeah, lots of digging into different media, like in different time periods, and it just was very, yeah,
a
detective. It was its own world.
Yeah,
know?
Well, you're a detective of your own life here, mm-hmm, and mm-hmm. Such, it took so much. Thanks for writing this, Morgan,
yes,
Parker.
Yes, thank you for reading.
You get what you pay for. Morgan Parker, today on Living Writers. You can see Morgan in town tomorrow at UMA. Zelle Visiting Writers Series. Thanks for bringing Morgan Parker here. Thanks to all of you for listening. Thanks to Jason for being behind the glass. Thanks to our parents for listening. Hi, Mom.
Hi, Mommy.
You get what you pay for. Morgan Parker. I'm T. Hetzel. Until next time.
Thank you.
Thank you. Live from Ann Arbor, welcome back to the Daily Sports Report here on WCBN FM Ann Arbor. I'm your host, Vihan Iswar, joining you for the second time this week. I'm joined by a smaller panel, but hey, quality over quantity. Today we've got Charlie and we've got Evan making his debut on the show. So, Evan, welcome to the show. It's great to have you aboard.
Glad
How
to be
are you
here.
Two feeling?
I'm doing fine.
Yep, I'm glad to be here for the first time.
Yeah, you know, I think temperatures dropping significantly in Ann Arbor has not been fun for a lot of us, especially since, Evan, I know you're an out-of-stater from, you know, yep. a slightly warmer climate. I myself am the same boat. I'm from New Jersey, and we get, it gets cold. It gets this cold in January. It does not get this cold before Christmas.
Yeah, waking up and seeing that the feels like was five degrees, that was tough.
Yeah, but, you know, it's cold weather doesn't preclude any of us from doing our jobs. I know we all have final season coming up. We all have a lot of work on our plates, a lot going on for us. So, and that means doesn't stop for WCBN either. So without further ado, we're going to jump right into it. We're going to talk some college football. Maybe we'll talk some men's basketball if we have time. But for starters, we'll talk about the big piece of news that actually came out, that was actually made public a few minutes before yesterday's DSR, which is why it wasn't mentioned on the show, but I think it's obviously something quite significant. It's been an ongoing storyline of the season. Michigan offensive coordinator Kirk Campbell was fired yesterday evening, I believe, and was replaced by, I believe, the interim receivers or tight ends coach. Tight ends coach, taking over as the interim manager. And obviously this is big news. I think Michigan's play calling was severely under fire from the fan base and national media for huge portions of the season, almost pretty much from the opener against Fresno State just down to last week's hugely